You're listening to The Kevin O'Connor Show. It's coming up next. Welcome back to The Kevin O'Connor Show. We got a really, really good one today with two guests. My good friend Spike Eskin, host of the Rights to Ricky Sanchez podcast, a host on WIP Radio in Philadelphia. He's coming up later to talk about the very lowly Philadelphia 76ers, 2-11 on the season. One of the things that Spike and I didn't hit was Nick Nurse taking 50 minutes to come out after the game. Team meeting for the Philadelphia 76ers tonight. Joel Embiid denied that there was a meeting after the game. Things are ugly in Philadelphia, but I can't bury the Sixers quite yet, as we talk about with Spike later on. But right now I'm bringing on Mo Dakhil from Bleacher Report to talk about Monday night's games in the NBA. It was a weird night in the NBA. The five leading scorers were RJ Barrett with 39, Keon Ellis with 33, Franz Wagner with 32, Jimmy Butler and Jakob Poeltl both with 30. Strange night in the NBA. We talked about a bunch of the games and a whole lot else. That's coming up next right after Father John Misty. All right, here's Mo Dakhil to talk about Monday night's games in the NBA. Mo, we just got done watching the Clippers and Warriors, a 102-99 victory for the Clippers. This looked like it was going to be over by kind of a wide margin with 2 minutes, 30 seconds left. The Clippers were up 10. And then suddenly, I'm going to take my allergy pill, thinking I'm going to take my allergy pill. I walk out of the room. I come back. It's 5. I see Wiggins hit a 3, Steph hit a layup. I'm playing catch up. Like, whoa, what happened? Then Wiggins hit another layup, and suddenly it's a 3-point game with 30 seconds left. Clippers ended up hanging on, but boy, that ended up being a fun one down the stretch.
I mean, it just goes to show you how quickly the leads can change, especially with the 3-ball now. But more importantly, like, against the Warriors, no lead is safe. It doesn't matter, man. Like, it doesn't matter. It's really just a dangerous game you're playing with. And I think the Clippers kind of took their foot off the gas pedal a little bit when they took that 10-point lead. Norman Powell hits a big three off a James Harden drive. And I think everybody was kind of like you, kind of like myself, where we both were like, all right, that should probably do it. And the Warriors just continue to push. This is what they do. And the Clippers' offensive possessions in that stretch were just awful, awful, and awful. Like, they were just bad ones. And then on that last play, it's a turnover from Powell that leads to an opportunity for the Warriors to tie it.
I mean, Powell had the turnover, but he was great throughout the night. He had 23 points, yeah, which he's also averaging on the season, 5 of 6 from three, ton of movement threes. Paul George leaves and Kawhi Leonard's out, but Norman Powell seems to be the guy that's elevating his play in a significant way for the Clippers this season to have them over 500. Did you see Powell as a guy who could take this type of leap?
No, and then it's kind of interesting in that, like, this is his 9th or 10th year in the NBA. Like, normally we kind of know who these guys are. Like, they might have a good run. We might just be in the midst of a good start to the season. Who knows? It's a long way to go to the end of the season to see if he continues to sustain this. But, you know, this is something I probably wasn't expecting to be able to produce at this level, you know, at any point in his career. And you know, maybe it's because he went to UCLA and I just, you know, we'll always have those guys on a lower value. it's a big week for us, Kevin. So there's no love for any UCLA alum players, yeah, or whatnot. But
yeah, you being a USC guy, I saw you at a UCLA location here in Los Angeles fairly recently, and you're just decked out in full on USC gear. What a troll, huh?
Not a troll. I'm just letting them know we run this city. It doesn't matter that we lost to them last year. We still run this city, Kevin.
I mean, they're facing UCLA on Saturday, right? I believe.
That's our rivalry game. And it's not been a great season for us. And it's rarely ever a great season for UCLA. So just need to make sure we get the win.
Oh, Caleb Williams also looking like a bust for the Chicago Bears. Beside the point, we're an NBA podcast.
Whoa, don't. We'll talk about you. Get Drake me on May the NFL
better.
Podcast.
Drake May better. Okay, Mo. Drake May.
Stop
much
it.
Better.
Stop it.
Please.
Stop
Caleb it. Williams. Bust. Not a leader. runs around, not a thrower.
Okay. That's, okay. Yeah, it's not at all that he's on. His coach is an absolute moron, but okay.
Caleb Williams, great weapons for a rookie. Okay, what's he doing with them? I'd love to see Drake May with those weapons.
Well, you know the key thing, though, is also having an offensive line. And see, we've gone down into football.
Sure, yes.
But having an offensive line is usually something that's somewhat important in football.
Yes, it is, absolutely, and Drake May knows that as well for the Patriots. A lot of young quarterbacks know that. On the Clippers, another thought on them. What's been clear to me so far this season, Mo, you're missing Kawhi Leonard. It feels like a fairly obvious statement, but this is very clearly a playoff team with Kawhi Leonard, right? And you're thinking about how early in the year it is right now, how these standings are going to dramatically change. The Clippers right now, though, they're 8-7 without Kawhi Leonard playing a game. And I can't help but think if at some point they get Kawhi Leonard back, is this a team that suddenly we could be talking about a lot differently as a potential sleeper if they can get Kawhi Leonard healthy April, May, and you would hope June? But if they can keep Kawhi healthy in those important months, we saw what he did last year when he was at his peak powers. There's still that guy deep down inside. Do you have any of that hope for the Clippers based off of what you've seen from everybody else on this roster so far early on in the year?
Yeah, because I think it's also just more than Norman Powell. Obviously, Harden's doing what he's doing. But, you know, you're getting a lot of contributions. First off, Zubac has been phenomenal this season and I think is kind of a guy that doesn't get covered enough for the way he's played for the Clippers over the years, but especially this season. I think you're getting contributions from guys like Terrence Mann. I think Chris Dunn was an unbelievable pickup for them, and he's producing for them. Coffey was awesome in this game tonight. Like, I think you're kind of just, for the Clippers, this was always their mentality kind of going into this season when they knew the situation with Kawhi was just, hey, all we have to do is be in the mix so that one Kawhi comes, we're going to be a team that's right there. And right now they're in the mix, you know, 8-7. It's early standing stuff is going to shift a lot, like you said, but they're right there and they're not in one of those situations where it's, if it was like, look, they're 4-12 or whatever it is, you know, you're kind of whole different outlook on the season right now at 8-7, two wins against a very good Warriors squad this season. Like you got to look at them and go like, man, if they do get Kawhi back, like, this is a team that's going to be dangerous.
You mentioned the Clippers have two wins against the Warriors. The Warriors fell to 10-3 in the season. There are three losses. They have two against the Clippers, as you said, and one against the undefeated Cleveland Cavaliers. Look, man, Golden State, they had a bit of a weaker schedule earlier in the year, but they beat some really tough, good teams. They beat Boston. They beat Oklahoma City. Golden State feels like a very real team to me that's going to stay at the top of the Western Conference. Do you agree or not?
God, I'm so just like, it's, I want to agree so badly, Kevin, but there's just a piece of me that does.
What do you not see?
I just don't see the second option, right? Like on a night like tonight, like when, hey, we're just going to really pressure the hell out of the guards, they don't get a lot from everybody else. And I think that's kind of the thing that concerns me about them, right? You're going to have sometimes, and Buddy Hield started the season unbelievably well, right? Like Andrew Wiggins has looked like the Andrew Wiggins when they went on that championship run, right? At least he looks much better than he has in years past. So like what you're seeing, but like I don't see anybody that I go, that is a clear cut, their number two option. On nights when Steph doesn't have it, that guy is going to pick it up, or that's the guy that can create for them on offense when Steph's on the bench. I don't see that. And I'm not, you know, like, as I think Kuminga's the second option by default, but I don't think that's a guy that I feel confident to say, like, for a team that's going to be championship caliber, I don't know if that's good enough. You know, Buddy Hield's hit or miss. Like, there's a lot of stuff where I just worry, where is that second option coming from? Defensively, they're rock solid. That part I'm not worried about. It is their second option to me.
I think that's a fair point. I do. I think with Golden State, they feel like one of those teams when I say they're going to be at the top of the standing still. I think regular season-wise, they're probably going to be okay. That concern you're talking about is more of a big playoff issue. where they're throwing two at Steph, getting the ball out of his hands, and the ball's finding its Lindy Waters in the corner, as it did tonight, or finding Gary Payton, misses the last one, or finds Draymond Green, who's shooting better, but you don't want Draymond shooting at the end of the clock necessarily. They don't have that second guy. Now, to push back a little bit here, in the Western Conference, OKC, they're without Chet right now. They're also still a very young team as well. Lakers, an old team with their own flaws. Houston, they don't necessarily have that top-end guy. They're another by-committee team. Phoenix, they have a bunch of guys at the top end. Denver has Jokic, but then Jamal Murray, Nuggets fans hate him right now. He has fallen off. He is not playing at his peak powers. So that's just the top six in the West. And then never mind Minnesota, who has had their own issues this season. Clippers, who are without Kawhi. Memphis, who have had who's the number two behind Ja Morant? Is it Desmond Bane, Jaren Jackson? Can they elevate to that level? There's a lot of questions. That's of the top eight teams right now. There's a lot of questions with those teams in the Western Conference right now. So I think that's where I would say with Golden State, maybe, you know, with their depth, that they can be one of those teams where they can lift Steph enough alone.
I mean, that's the good news for them, right? Is that, hey, like, the West is not at all shaking out in a way where you're just saying, hey, these are the two dominant teams or whatnot, and the road goes through all of these, you know, goes through this team. There is no team that we can say is definitively the roadblock in the Western Conference. But it also is, there's going to be movement. There's going to be changes. Somebody's going to take a big swing. Houston's probably itching to pull the trigger to find that top line guy, right? You know, if the right opportunity comes.
Who though? Giannis?
I don't know who. It's not going to be Giannis. We can just stop with all
Kevin
that.
Kevin Durant? No. So that's the thing. Like, who? I just don't think that guy's going to be available Kevin, this
you know,
year.
You know this season. You know the way this league works. It could change in a week. Like, just all of a sudden, somebody gets upset and, oh, okay, no, I want out or whatnot or things like that. There's that.
Joel Embiid? No, I mean, I don't know if you want to trade for Joel Embiid, right? Exactly. Right.
Nobody's jumping in for that. But, like, I just think in general, though, I'm just saying, like, there could be a lot of movement.
Is Jimmy Butler
going to
move the needle for Houston? I don't know.
You know, but there's just – but all I'm saying is, like, there's a possibility of stuff that's going to happen. It's a long way to just a trade deadline. You yes. know, in that sense and stuff like that. There's a lot of move. The Warriors might be the team that makes the move, by the way. Like, it's not it's not out of the realm of possibility. Like, there's a lot of stuff there in that stuff. There's a lot of stuff that's going to change through the course of the season as we go through it. But just right now, like, it looks great for the Warriors. So, like, you know, my reservations aside, like, yeah, there's definitely a reason to just look at them and go, like, yeah, they can definitely come out of the West. All eight teams you named. I mean, like, I'd feel confident about, like, five of them coming out of the West. It's just that tough, and that's how deep the West is this year.
Earlier in the night, we had the Sacramento Kings and the Atlanta Hawks face off. Heartbreaking loss for the Kings. De'Aaron Fox got stripped at the end of the game. Might have even gotten fouled. Dyson Daniels got his strip at the end of the game on Fox, Fox over the weekend kind of got lost. Fox, because it was on a Friday night in Minnesota. Fox had 60 against Minnesota, and then on Saturday against Utah, he had 49. Fox became the first player to total 109 points or more in consecutive days since Kobe Bryant did it when he scored 110 points back in 2007, March 22nd and 23rd. And Fox became just the third player to do it after Wilt Chamberlain did it way back when. And then he had 28. On Monday against Atlanta without DeMontis Sabonis, who was out for the second consecutive game with a back injury, without DeMar DeRozan, also out with a back injury, and without Malik Monk. So De'Aaron Fox has been on this absolute tear without his co-stars. He's scoring 1.2 points per pick and roll possession this season, which ranks in the 97th percentile according to Synergy. That's a career high for him. Are you seeing anything different from Fox this year with him elevating his play as of late, or do you see this more of just a super scorching hot stretch for him?
I think we're seeing him kind of mature into being the guy he wants to be as a basketball player. And yeah, I think he's stepping up tonight and the past few games with the guys out with injuries. He's really taken it upon himself where he's put the team on his back and he's carried them. Look, they lost that game against Minnesota, but it's because of him that they were even in double overtime, or excuse me, just regular overtime. But it's just the sense of like he is doing all of this work to take the team as far as he can. Like, I just think this is one of those stretches where we're watching and going like, yeah, this is the dude that is capable of being a star in this league. It's pretty plain and simple. I think it's been up and down over the past few years with him and lately been more up, especially since Sabonis has come through. I think this is the guy that you're saying, like, yeah, this is why he was drafted as high as he was in Sacramento. Like, this is the guy. This is your franchise player, and this is the way he's playing. I just think he's a special guy. And his speed, at the end of the day, Kevin, nobody can keep up with him. He's too fast.
He's so fast. I mean, he was going at Dyson Daniels. Daniels, who is a clear-cut first-team all-defensive guy this season. I thought Fox did a good job at creating for himself when defended by Daniels on Monday night.
It was a lot of work, you know. I mean, like, listen, Daniels is hard, like, to score and get by him and things like that. I thought he did a great job with him. I mean, except obviously that last play, and we'll let everybody else complain.
Odds are he got fouled. He probably got fouled. Yeah.
You know, foul or not, like, it's a tough one there, and that's just how you take it. And I think if you don't get this call this time, you'll get it down the stretch later in another game. It all evens out in the long run. But I mean, that's just how good of a defender Daniels is. But more importantly, like, that's how hard Fox had to work tonight to get his stuff when he had Daniels on him. And for the most part, he did. He was able to produce.
Daniels, first in steals on the season. He has 44 steals. Next closest is Tari Eason with 29. Daniels, first in deflections. He has 88. Fox is second with 53. I feel like New Orleans made a mistake getting rid of him and trading what they did to go get DeJounte Murray.
I actually don't, because I don't know if he would have actually been able to be this guy in New Orleans, right? Like, because
I've heard Jones and Ingram and all the guys and the bodies they have there.
It's just hard sometimes to break through a lineup sometimes, right? In a rotation and find your spot. And I think that's the important thing that you need to be looking at when we talk about it. It's a sign of how deep the league is in general, where you can trade like your guy who doesn't get minutes and all of a sudden he's the steals leader the next year. And of course, hindsight's 2020. I'm sure they're all going like, wow, we weren't ready for this, you know. I think also we would be looking at New Orleans differently if they were fully healthy. In that sense, and maybe walk away and say, oh, the trade made a little more sense, but now injuries kind of ruined that for them. But Daniels, just the tenacity defensively from him is really impressive, especially from the young guy, and having that IQ and that timing to pick up all these steals. Those numbers you kind of just laid out, he could take a week off. Nobody's coming near him still. Like, it doesn't, you know, like, it's that's how far ahead he is from everybody else. Like, this is the first game he didn't record a steal over the past few. And when he had been recording steals, it was 5-6 a night. Like, he's going to have a triple double one time, and it's going to be because he had 10 steals.
I mean, he absolutely is. And the other guy who defended Fox a bit tonight was Zachary Risacher, rookie on the Hawks. I think there's no doubts he's been very impressive defensively. That was something that everybody knew coming in after he played last season overseas. A good on-ball defender, a headsy off-ball defender for a young guy. What have your impressions been of Risacher early on in his NBA career with Atlanta?
Well, I think it's very clearly, like we said, like, the defense is ahead of his offense, but his offense doesn't seem to be that far behind. It's just consistency, right? Tonight, a really nice game, 3 of 5 from three, you know, able to kind of spread the floor and so on and keep the game kind of going where it's like, hey, we can keep him on the floor because he's not hurting us on offense. I think that was the concern offensively. I'd like to see him rebound a little bit more, a little bit better. But beyond that, I think, you know, it's the growing pains from a young guy. I've liked what I've seen. Like, for the way we talked about this rookie, this draft class, you know, in June, I feel like maybe a little bit of a chip on his shoulder for most of these guys. Like, he's actually paid off pretty well, and he looks pretty solid for what he brings to the table, especially on the defensive end. The identity of this team is shaping up to be quite a defensive team, like going forward in the future with Daniels, with Richichet. You know, I like what they're kind of building in that area over in Atlanta.
Yeah, I mean, I like what they're building defensively. I just hope Richichet can find consistency on offense, because we've seen the flashes. 18 points tonight, 3 of 5 from three. The problem was that he was 1 of 19 from three before this, after right. his 33-point explosion when he went 6 for 10 from three. So that was his big breakout, but 1 of 19 for three since then until tonight. Like, this was my concern with Richichet prior to the draft. It is still my concern today. How consistent can he be as a shooter? He had a massive hot stretch in the first half of last season overseas. He shot nearly 50% from three, but for the rest of his professional career, he's been around 27% from three, closer to where his numbers are so far this season with Atlanta. Below sub 70% shooter from three, from the free throw line, I'm sorry. I just have concerns about what his true ability is as a shooter. But the flashes, those big nights, he looks like a 3-and-D guy at a minimum, but he can do more than that because he's tall, he can cut, he can attack a closeout, he has versatility, he's willing as a screener, he'll do all the dirty work. Richichet checks every box, except for the big the shooting one. That's a big one.
It's a huge one, and I think it just kind of comes down to, it's like you said, it's turning those flashes into just, you know, more the norm than not, and where we don't go like, oh, it was a flash. Like, once we stop describing it as a flare up type of situation, I think it's something that's going to go there. And that's something that maybe that will hopefully come in time. There's no way to project and guarantee one way or the other. You know, I think we've seen guys that have come in the league as bad shooters, even as subpar free throw shooters, improve over time with training and the extra sessions that they would need. But I'm just kind of cautiously optimistic. I'm hopeful. I'm trying to be an optimist, Kevin. I'm hopeful that it's going to continue there. But this is a stretch, and we just need to see more of these types of nights and less of stretches of 1 and 19. The good news with that is the 1 and 19 didn't discourage him from taking more shots, right? He didn't. Okay, I'm 1 and 19. I ain't shooting the three ball no more. At least he understands the situation of like, I have to make this shot. I have to get better at this shot. I have to provide consistency. And it's hard for a young guy to have to do it. Listen, coming out of college, coming from Europe, whatever, when you're playing in the NBA, it's a whole different deal. It's a game every other night, if not back-to-backs, all of those things. There's less amount of practice time. There's a lot of adjustment for the young guys to come in and try to figure this stuff out on the fly as well. Like, this is why when I was with the Spurs, Chip England used to say he would never mess with a rookie shot. They got enough that they got to take in, you know, learning just to be a pro in the NBA. He wouldn't mess with anybody their rookie season. That offseason, though, he's going to be all over him. So for me, whatever we get from him shooting wise this year, it is what it is. I want to see the growth over the next 2 or 3 years after that.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk about a young guy that I once said will be a top 20 player in the NBA. First, I just want to remind you as a listener, please subscribe. If you have not done so already, it really does help out the show. All right, Mel, you had mentioned that you worked with the San Antonio Spurs way back when. You were a video coordinator, right? And you mentioned Chip England.
Yeah, it wasn't way back when. You make me sound old now. Like, damn, Kev.
what years were you with the Spurs? And I'll ask you specifically. What years?
Oh, I forget. I'm old. It's too old. I don't remember. So, no, I was there 2009 to 2011.
Oh, that was a long ass time ago.
Well, not long ass time ago. Jeez. Gosh. Killing me.
Tell me the secrets of Chip England. What does he do? Like, what? Like, he is renowned as the greatest shooting coach in the world. Like, what approach does he take when it comes to helping a shooter improve?
If I had the secrets, I'd still be in the league. So let's just be honest there in terms of if I had the full Chip England secret sauce. But I think it's also just one, Chip does an incredible job of really just understanding a guy's shot, breaking down the full mechanics. I mean, you know, in the draft, you know, he's studying everybody's shots before we even draft anybody, and gives his notes as to what, you know, the breakdown of this shot needs no work, this one needs tweaking, this one's a full rebuild of a shot, you know, and things like that. Like, he's kind of having a full understanding of that stuff. And then when he's working with players, I think it's kind of, I don't want to say getting into their heads in the way that would have a bad connotation, but just having an understanding and being able to reach them and explain to them very, you know, this is what you need to work on. This is how we need to get there. And this is the process, you know. And I think the most important thing he does is he gets them to stay with the process. I don't think when people understand, when you're going to say, all right, we're going to fix somebody's shot, you're asking them to change a muscle memory and change something that they're not used to doing. And then when they have to do that, first off, every time they shoot, it's going to feel wrong to them for the longest time until their body gets used to it. And in that process, they're also going to miss thousands of shots. It's hard to, like, you know, it's going to be hard to feel like you're making progress. And I think Chip does a great job of keeping guys in the program, staying with the program and understanding. And he shows them the progress. You know, not just necessarily the makes, but hey, it's different. You're missing exactly the same way as the same way every time. And from that, it shows that you're developing this, and Chip's able to kind of get those guys kind of following along. Like, he's done a phenomenal job. He's rebuilt a lot of guys' shots from there. And I think, you know, it's impressive, you know, his run as basically to me, the premier shooting coach in the league.
And now he's in Oklahoma City and helping rebuild guys' shots there. We saw up and down progress, but Giddey made some progress last year with OKC. Then he just got, you know, completely ignored in the postseason. It showed the difference between regular season improvement and translating it to a postseason setting.
It's hard. Like, I don't think people understand. Like, at a certain, in the playoffs, teams are just going to say, like, cool, You were better shooter in the regular season. We're still going to leave you, only because we still have to cover Shea. We still have to cover Chet. We still have to cover Jalen Williams. Like, it's a very difficult scenario sometimes, and it takes a while to actually get to the point where teams have to actually cover you.
Absolutely. And then I think I wanted to talk about Franz Wagner, because he's a guy that I have long loved. I loved Franz in the draft. I loved him in his career with Orlando. And then at some point in the middle of the last season, his shot just collapsed. He became a hesitant shooter. His volume went down. His percentages went down below 30%. And that carried him to the Olympics, where he just was a complete zero as a shooter from three. But lately, no Paolo Banchero for the Orlando Magic. And yet they've won six games in a row with Franz Wagner leading the way. He's averaging 29 points, 6.3 assists, six rebounds, only one turnover over the six-game winning streak, one turnover per game, shooting 37% from three on a higher volume. It seems to me like Franz Wagner has gotten over whatever was plaguing his shot before, because Franz Wagner looks like a guy who is indeed taking the leap, and tonight the Magic won their sixth in a row, beating the Suns. And once again, Wagner was an unbelievable two-way superstar. Franz Wagner, I said many years ago, he's going to be a top 20 player in the NBA. I got laughed at for it. Mo, does Franz Wagner have a chance to be a top 20 player in the NBA?
Sure.
Yes. No, yeah. Yes. He's definitely been top 20 for the last six games. That's for damn sure.
For sure. There's no question. I mean, when you look at the fact that the way he stepped up with the Banchero injury, how he's able to kind of been that guy for the Magic, it almost makes me wonder if he needed that. Like, he needed to have that put on his plate of like, hey, man, you're responsible now for everything. My favorite thing for tonight isn't his shooting, isn't the defense, although I love the defense. It's the eight assists to one turnover tonight. You're looking at those things, like that's one of the things they're missing from Banchero, right? Like, he was such an important playmaker for them. Having Franz kind of step up and being able to do that, I think will open things up so that when Paolo comes back, I think you're going to see a lot more, you know, Franz still being this guy again, you know, and being the guy that we all kind of thought he was until he started to have that major slump last year. And I don't know what it was, what brought him into that slump, how he fell into that or whatnot. But it does feel like he's broken out of that. And I feel like I still believe he can be a huge player for the Magic. I love the tandem of him and Paolo. I think they play really well off of each other, work well off of each other. And I think this kind of responsibility he's had to take on is only going to help the Magic going forward once they get Paolo back.
I mean, look, the thing with Franz is, like, we talk about shooters who can improve and get better. Franz has always been a elite touch guy from the free throw line, 85% from the line, elite touch guy near the basket. And so when you talk about three-point shooting projected improvement in the future, Franz has always been a guy that I'd feel really confident betting on. Franz, this year, only 35% from three. His career high is only 36% from three. But if he continues ticking up, this is still only year four of his career. He's still only 23 years old. If you're talking about Franz at 26, 27, 28 years old in the prime years of his career, when Banchero's in his prime too, I mean, the Magic, as elite as their defense already is, their offense is making progress this year. Their young guys are getting better. The Magic are one of these teams, man. Like, when you're talking about who's the next championship contender, Orlando's near the top of the list if you're talking about Eastern Conference teams. I think they are at the top of the list when you're talking about Eastern Conference teams that aren't already established.
Well, I mean, just look at it this way. Like, they're looking fine when they had Paolo. Paolo gets hurt, and I think we all kind of just assumed, all right, well, it's going to be a bit rocky for them. They're third in the Eastern Conference. They're the only other team in the East besides Boston and Cleveland to have a winning record at the current moment. And I think, New York has jumped in there as well. But they're one of four teams now that have kind of jumped into that area. I don't think we were expecting Orlando after Paolo had that injury to kind of be in that situation and to be third in the Eastern Conference right now. I think it's a very fair assessment with that stuff. I think this team has a lot of promise. It starts on the defensive end. I love the talent that they have around them. I think they have a lot of opportunities. You can correct me if I'm wrong. They still have all their picks.
Anthony Black, I mean, Jalen Suggs, like, oh my God, the backcourt. All these guys are looking good.
It's going to get interesting when contract extensions come in and the contract starts to get, you know, go up. And then you have to start figuring out first apron, second apron situations and things like that. They got to continue to draft well. They've done a good job, except for that Jet Howard pick, which is still, I will never understand that one. But I think for the most part, they've done a good job building this team. My only fear with this, Kevin, is sometimes these guys, teams just feel like they have to rush it. Let this team grow together and continue to kind of build. I don't feel like you're in the situation right now where you have to make a massive move to go get somebody. You know, I think just let this whole thing build, you know, naturally, build in the draft, be opportunistic in trades and in free agency. I think just be smart right now at this point because their time's coming.
So the Magic are third in the Eastern Conference. Second is Boston. First is Cleveland, the undefeated 15-0 Cleveland Cavaliers, tied for the second best start to a season in NBA history. Back in 1949, the Washington Capitals, coached by Red Auerbach, by the way, started the season 15-0. Back in 93-94, the Houston Rockets started 15-0. Number one was the Warriors in 15-16 when they started 24-0. All three of those previous teams that started 15-0 reached the NBA Finals. All three of them. Only the 93-94 Rockets were the only one of those three that actually won the finals, though. Do you believe in the Cavaliers as a finals contender, Mo, on the level of the Boston Celtics, or are they still a tier or two tiers below Boston in your eyes, despite this fast start?
I think if you told me the beginning of the season, I'd have said they're at least a tier, if not two. I think at the very least right now, we have to look at it and say there are a tier behind Boston. And the only reason why I say that is Boston isn't healthy. It's entirely different Boston Celtics team when they have Kristaps Porzingis, right? Like, as good as everything is, Kristaps really takes this team to another level, you know, both offensively and defensively. So that said, I love this Cleveland team. This team has been awesome to watch. I think Kenny Atkinson has done a phenomenal job getting buy-in from the top four guys into how to play with each other and how to work off of each other, and mainly Garland and Mitchell. They've done a phenomenal job, the two of them, working basically second side actions with one another. One guy drives, finds the kick out, the other one will get it, you know, an attack. There's so many different ways in which they're kind of working. I love everything that I've seen from them. And the more important thing is they've all bought in. And I think that's the big one. For me, of course, the big problem is they still have that. I wish they had another wing player. You know, I am worried defensively. Teams are going to pick on Garland on the defensive end. They're going to pick on Mitchell, you know, and I think that's going to be really interesting. That's more of a playoff issue. But I think that's something that they got to figure out how to solve at some point. And I think that's going to be a big one for them. So I still have them just a tier behind Boston, but they're coming.
Could we see Boston begin to try to exploit that starting on Tuesday? Because I'd imagine Boston's going to come out with a game plan, fully prepared, playoff mode, trying to prove something against this undefeated team. Because it's getting to the point now that I think Cleveland is going to get the best of every opponent. Like, you want to be the team that takes down the Cavs and ends their undefeated streak. So do you think Boston starting Tuesday, that this is going to be one of those games where we see two serious game plans going in, that it is a matchup that's indicative of something Cleveland could face come postseason time?
Yeah, they won't admit it, but it's definitely one of those moments where you're looking and going like, yo, they're on our block. We got to, you know, nip this in the bud. We got to win this. And it's one of those things.
Boston hasn't played since Saturday. They've had days to prepare for this too.
Well rested, sitting and confident and sort of put the game plan together, can really install the game plan if you're Joe Mazzulla. I think there's a lot of opportunities with everything that you have. But I think for me, if you're Boston, not only do you want to win this, you want to win this big. And you want to send this message right away to Cleveland going like, you may be 15-0 to start the season, but this is how far behind us you are. And we're not even fully healthy yet. And I think you're right. I do think we're going to see early on, we're going to see them go after Garland. I think they're going to make it known like, hey, you're going to have to figure out how to guard Tatum when you get switched on to him, how to guard Brown when you get switched on to him, how you're going to guard Derek White when you get switched on to him. I'm not sure if Holiday is going to be playing or not. I think last I saw he was questionable or something. But I think more importantly, they're going to make you have to think about these things. And if you're Boston, this is your first chance to say, hey, you're still our little brother. You know, we're still the big dogs on this block. We're letting you guys know that. And I think they have to come out with a strong intensity. Sometimes we see this Boston group kind of, well, you know, you don't take Atlanta seriously and you lose in you know, last Tuesday, and you kind of are not really up to snuff. And, you know, it takes a Jason Tatum game winner to beat Toronto. I think there's a lot of stuff where, like, you want to come in and you want to have that serious mentality of not only do we want to win, we want to beat the living crap out of you.
I mean, with all that said, we're still in the middle of November at this point. And
oh, yeah.
The NBA Cup, the great purpose of it is to define the first 3 months of the season, which typically don't have all too much importance come April. Like, April's a long ways away. It's after the trade deadline. There's a lot that can change by April. Do you put much importance into this game? Like, is there anything that we can look at in this Tuesday game come April or May when Boston and Cleveland might have a series? Or is this just purely the point of the NBA Cup? The point is to give meaning to these early season games. Is this all it is?
No, I think there's actually value in it to April and okay, whatnot. First off, it's an opportunity to go, okay, if you're Cleveland, all right, how do we answer these questions? You know, and let's see what these things look like on film. And, you know, what works, what doesn't work, what do we need to tweak, where should we make changes and whatnot. Like, all of this is always data gathering. all 82 games matter in the sense of, at the very least, it's gathering information for when you get to the playoffs. And, you know, whether it's how do we play, how do we play this particular opponent, what worked against them, what didn't work, and things like that. And then the whole tweaking behind it. But more than that, and I know it sounds silly, but I think you want to, especially if you're Boston, again, you want to assert your dominance right away. You want to let these guys know we're still the NBA champs.
Yeah, we still own you. After beating them in five, we still own you. Like, still.
Exactly. I mean, it's not even that. It's like, just think about last season, Indiana and Milwaukee. Indiana kept beating Milwaukee.
Yes.
In the regular season and
in the NBA games, Cup.
Beat them in the NBA Cup, started even a little bit of a rivalry and things like that. We know in the playoffs, the Bucks were severely injured. Obviously, no Giannis. So obviously, it becomes very challenging to win. But you can't tell me that those wins early in the season didn't help Indiana in terms of confidence and having an attitude. It also, they beat Boston in the NBA Cup last year as well, you know, to get to Vegas, and they play them in the conference finals, you know, and there's a little bit, and they played them tough in the conference finals. They didn't win a game, but they led, it felt like, in almost every down the stretch in all of those games. You know, there's a level of confidence building. It's like, we can do this, right? It's a situation. And whether that game's in November, whether it's in January, whether it's in March or in April, it all matters. It all carries over in that area. And I think it's a very important thing. So for me, this is the first important matchup for Boston and for Cleveland.
On the other games on Tuesday, that's the big one. That's the first game of the night, Cleveland and Boston. But with Tuesday's NBA Cup games, we got the Hornets at Nets, the Nuggets at Grizzlies, the Pelicans at Mavericks, the Thunder at Spurs. Boy, damn, I wish Chet was healthy for that.
Against
Victor. But even Victor could be out for that game as well. And then we have the Jazz against the Lakers as well. Do you like the NBA Cup, Mo? I'm a fan of it because these are typically quote-unquote meaningless early regular season games. Everybody's focused on the NFL. It just spices things up. It's better than what we had before. So I'm excited for these games more than I am on a standard night.
Just to be clear, like, my position long before this started was no, I hated it. Didn't like it. Didn't like the idea. The whole thing was always like, what are we doing? All this stuff. Man, I love it. Yes. They nailed it.
And
the most important thing about it is when you watch these games, the intensity of these games is playoff level.
Yes.
It's not, and that's credit to the players, the coaches, because they're the ones that are going to make, if the NBA Cup's going to be a thing, it's going to be because those guys care, right? We know what it looks like when they don't care. Just go check out any of the All-Star games of the last like 10 years. But when they care, you get this. And there's an intensity level in that stuff. And I love the point differential. I think that was a great addition to the NBA Cup because it matters. And now you have the teams that it's going, go look at the game with Cleveland against Chicago. That was like a 4-point game with 4 minutes left on Friday. They go on like a 20-0 run, you know, and they end up blowing Chicago. That's huge for them, the point differential stuff. That stuff matters. That stuff plays a role into it. And you see kind of even a chippiness in the Blazers-Wolves game at the NBA Cup. And there's a lot of that stuff. And it has a playoff vibe in most of these games. So for me, like, they've nailed it. They got in it. They got the most important thing, which is the buy-in from the players and the coaches. And I think it's been a success last year. And I said, it's going to be a success last year because it's new. I'm very excited to see it. Like, we've had great games this season off of that. And I think, you know, it's a big reason why.
Last thing, Mo, before I let you go, you mentioned the All-Star game, how poor the competition has been. On Friday, Sham Charania from ESPN reported that the NBA is having serious discussions with a new tournament style format for the 2025 All-Star game, and that would consist of three All-Star teams of eight players each and the winner of the Rising Stars team. The Rising Stars game. And so those four teams would face each other in other matchups. You know, it could be the one seed versus the three seed and the two versus the four, which would be the Rising Stars winner. And then the winners would move on to the final round. I'm a big fan. Let's do it. Let's go. Tournament style, some quicker, fast-paced games. Let's make it happen. This is a no-brainer because the regular All-Star game blows. It sucks. It is just not worth time. I've been to All-Star weekend before. Sunday is by far the worst from my own personal perspective, and it is no doubt the worst from the fan perspective. People are not into that like they are on Saturday night, and even the Friday night's events are often more entertaining. Sunday sucks. It blows. So to me, this is a clear win that's at least worth trying. And I bet with this tournament style, it could make things more interesting for the players too. So yes, go for it. Please, NBA. Do you agree with me, Mo?
Yeah. I'm for experimenting as much as possible, yes, especially with the All-Star game, because clearly what we're doing is not working. Listen, when they made the change where it was draft your team and have the Elam ending the first year, it was great. And we had a lot of intensity behind that, you know, and that was a fun All-Star game. And then after that, it wore off. So, you know, if it's this year, we're going to get a lot of excitement. Great. I want to see what it is beyond this year. But you had to make a change. It just wasn't working. And honestly, I think this is one of those things where you got it. This is when I wish at times we had Adam Silver was more like David Stern. Because this is when you need David Stern to be yelling at the players going like, don't you guys understand? You have to put on a show. Like, you have to compete for, like, this matters for the good of the league and for the health of the league. Can't be a joke, man. Like, that's the problem. Like, All-Star Weekend is meant to showcase the league and our top talent in that All-Star game. There has to be a level of pride from these guys when they're an All-Star to actually perform. Like, nothing pisses me off more than a guy who goes and says, I only want to play 2 minutes. You know, because what, you know, whatever, I want to get back to my team or whatnot or things like that. Like, I get it, but also, like, you need to respect the game and the honor you get as being an All-Star. So if this is going to change it and we're going to get competitive games out of it, I'm all for it. I just hope it's something that it's a format that we can stick to and that the players will ride with over the next few years. You know, I think, like we talked about, the NBA Cup is a success because you got buy-in from the players. You know, if you're going to get All-Star, will be a success. Any format in All-Star will be a success if you get buy-in from the players to fully compete.
Yes.
It's exactly. Just that simple.
It's all on the players, ultimately, more than anything else. It's on the players and the league to create something that makes incentives. And so hopefully that there's some type of incentive out there in this game as well. But ultimately, the incentive is you're an All-Star and you get paid hundreds of millions of dollars and you're on a national stage and you have a chance to promote your game and your brand to a massive audience, because All-Star ratings still are through the roof, even though the game itself is very stinky. So hopefully this helps matters, and that could, you know, gain some new longtime NBA fans as well if these games are fun. Mo, I appreciate you joining me on today's show. Where can we find your stuff this season?
Writing at Bleacher Report. I am doing stuff with the NBA. I'm doing a pregame and postgame for the NBA Cup. It's on the NBA app and I believe on some of their socials. But, you know, Tuesdays and Fridays, I'm all over the place. I'm all over the NBA app. So go check it out starting tomorrow or today, whenever this posts.
Appreciate you, Mo, for joining me. Next up on the Kevin O'Connor Show, we have Spike Eskin from WIP Radio in Philadelphia and the longtime host of the Only Sixers podcast, The Rights to Ricky Sanchez. Now we bring on Spike Eskin from The Rights to Ricky Sanchez. Spike, 2-11 for the Sixers tonight, blowing a 19-point lead, losing 106-89 to the Miami Heat. My goodness, could it have been any more worse with your worst nightmares this preseason? I don't think so. This is horrible.
No, this is far worse than I think everyone could have imagined. If you had asked me what would the worst case scenario be for 13 games, I don't know, 5-8 or something, like I would have never imagined that they would have been as bad. And not just bad, but like you watch the games and it feels like sort of hopeless the entire time. Even when they're winning, it feels like they're going to lose, you know, at this point. I haven't felt this way in a really long time about the Sixers. Like, that I'm sure they're going to lose the entire game, you know?
It felt like this way in a different way during the process because it was intentional. Yeah. You were trying to lose, but this is a team. They wait a year. They don't make moves. They do successfully go out and get Paul George. It feels like a success with the offseason additions. You get Caleb Martin. His shot has fallen apart. He's also struggling from the free throw line, for that matter. Kyle Lowry looks washed and old recently. The role players don't look like they're making the impact that they're supposed to. Literally, the only bright spot has been Jared McCain, but that doesn't change the fact that Joel Embiid comes back and, dude, he's getting roasted in his drop coverage. He looks slow. I know supposedly sick tonight and he was doubtful to play. He ended up playing, but that doesn't change the fact he looked like this last week as well. He just doesn't look healthy.
Yeah. See, I'm trying to weigh between my emotional response to this and answering what you're asking, because my emotional response to this is, like, I was good with the plan for him this year, right? Like, when they, I was good with the no back-to-backs. I was good with the miss however many games to start the season to ramp up, with the intention that, like, what we were led to believe, or what the whole thing was supposed to be, is that when he started, he would be in physical condition to play, right? So understanding that in the first game, he hadn't played an NBA game in 6 months, I expect him to be winded, his timing to be off, like all that sort of stuff. But to look so dead in the second halves of the games so far, specifically in the Orlando game and the Miami game, and to, you mentioned getting roasted in drop coverage, doesn't seem to be like even attempting to get rebounds at all, like passing up shots. He always looks bad when he first comes back from injury, but this was not supposed to be the way that it was supposed to be this year. The whole intent with starting him at this point in the season and letting him get to a point was that he wouldn't start that way, and he doesn't look like he's in shape. So he is either way out of shape or his knee is way worse than we were led to believe, and both of those things are really, really bad. If it's the second one, I feel bad for him. You know, I feel bad for the Sixers as a franchise. If it's the first one, it's just entirely unacceptable. And it makes you wonder if the sort of maturation process that you thought he went through, and the things that he said coming into this year about it not being about individual awards and not being about, you know, proving people wrong, just about winning, if that was all just bullshit, is kind of what you wonder. It's been horrible. And the team otherwise, even all the things, you know, Kyle Lowry looks washed, all these things that you mentioned, they're all true, but they have enough decent players to not be embarrassing. Like, that's the problem, right? The Pistons win games and the Hornets win games. All these teams win some games.
The Nets compete, for that matter, too. There's a lot of quote unquote bad teams that are competitive, but they look dead at times. They look dead in that third quarter. That's the thing that's so bothersome. It happens time and time again this season where it's like, where is the effort? Where is the fight? Where's the heart from this team? And that stems from leadership, whether that's due to Nick Nurse maybe losing his voice in the locker room, or whether it's due to Joel Embiid not being the leader that he needs to be. But there's something missing at the core of this team when third quarters like that happen.
Yeah, it's just like the other team waits around for when they know they need to play hard, and then they play hard and it's done. And you start to realize that's happening in the first half, where you have this encouraging thing, but then you realize that it's the NBA and the other team knows they can just sort of mess around for the first half of the game and obliterate you. You know, it is that is the specific thing that is frustrating, is that in those second halves, it is a lack of concentration and effort that is not something I'm used to seeing, quite honestly. You know, that the number of times that they just lazily pass the ball to the other team and the other team gets a breakaway layup in the second half of these games, just careless passing, as you mentioned, very low effort, very low concentration. They don't call out screens. They don't, when Embiid's getting double teamed and somebody comes from behind him, nobody calls it out. That's not giving Embiid a pass. It's like, where is this?
And is that on Nurse?
I don't know. You know what I mean? Like,
is it too early to tell right now if it's on Nurse or not? Because it's so easy to blame the coach.
It is. That's I've always said, because you know, I've worked in sports radio for a long time and doing the podcast, that people usually like to blame the coach right away because it's easier than dealing with the truth of what's actually going on. It's easier saying like the team's cooked or something. So I think it is reflective of him, but I also think it's reflective of Joel, you know, that they are the leaders on the team. And I understand Nick Nurse's frustration to get in here and not know, you know, have this many new pieces. They lose Paul George. They lose Maxey. He doesn't know when Embiid's going to play. But like these, I wouldn't expect that from these players. They didn't sign a bunch of losers. You know, Caleb Martin's not a loser. Kyle Lowry's not a loser. You know, Gershon Yabusele worked his ass off to get back into the league. You could make jokes about Paul George, but Paul George has been on good teams in his career. So this, I just didn't expect any of this from them. So it would be easy to say it's the coach. The coach is certainly not doing anything to remedy what's wrong. I think is it that one thing that you could say for sure, but to your point, I don't want to let the players off the hook by just saying that it's Nick Nurse. And I find it unlikely that Morey would fire Nurse. I don't think he would fire him. I don't think he'd fire him midseason. My guess would be that wouldn't happen. So I don't know. I don't know if it's Nurse or it's not Nurse. But when the team isn't trying hard and they're not concentrating and they're not executing and they don't seem to have any personal pride or sense of urgency to just make it stop, you know, or at least make it look like they're trying to do that. Ultimately, I guess that falls back on the coach.
Despite how bad the team's been this year, Spike, I can't bury him yet. I can't do it with the Sixers. They're 2-11, but the Eastern Conference is just so bad behind Boston and Cleveland at the top. Philly's still only 4 games back from the 5 seed. There's a long way to go over the course of the season. And part of me is looking at the situation, like you talk about the Nets as a team that's playing hard, the Pistons, the Bulls, the Hornets, some of these teams in the Eastern Conference that are putting up a fight and winning some games. That's all true. It's very early in the season. We're still only in the middle of November. And for Philly, they're in a spot where you can make excuses for them in terms of George did miss time. Maxey's been out. Embiid's just coming back right now. It's still his preseason in some ways. So the team the key guys have been in and out of the lineup. In some ways, you can make those excuses. It does not excuse the effort level that we're talking about, the lack of concentration you mentioned with the turnovers. All of that is inexcusable. But the record at the end of the day at 2-11, I just can't see that they're going to be the 15 seed when the season's done. There's no way.
Yeah, you keep saying that. Not like I've said the same thing. I did the same thing with like, look at how bad the rest of the conference is. But you're the worst of the bad.
I know. The Wizards are also 2-11.
Yes. And
it's not company you want with Andrew Sharpe's favorite team. You do not want that.
I always like when we're doing not the Sixers pod, like the radio show, we're talking about another sport. I'll say when your team's behind in basketball, you start doing, you know, the team's going to lose when it's in the fourth quarter and you go, all we need is from the hit a three, get a stop, hit a three, get a stop, hit another three, and then we're right back in it. And that's what it's sort of starting to feel like the standings are, where, yeah, we're only 4 games out of the 5 seed. And that's true, but you have to win. Like, you have to catch up to them by winning games. And they can't get to the 5 seed unless they win a bunch of games. And I just, maybe I'm making it sound worse than it is, but I can't remember. I've been watching basketball a long time. I don't remember a lot of 2-11 teams all of a sudden turning it on and being, I'm sure they exist, right? But you have to be pretty bad to be in this situation and not just unlucky. And they've been unlucky.
How many 2-11 teams have a former MVP, all NBA guy in Paul George, all-star in Maxey, McCain, who could be the rookie of the year, and a bunch of, at least on paper, quality role players? Like, how many of these 2-11 teams in history have had these ingredients? Like, they have the pieces to I'm not saying they're going to be a top four seed, but how does this team not go on a run with this talent unless Joel Embiid is indeed cooked? If he's cooked, then yeah, it's over. Like, the season's done. Maybe they scratch their way up to the 11 or 12, but they need Embiid to be MVP level Embiid. That's obvious.
Yeah, but okay, that's for sure. But then you would say the thing that we thought going into this season was, based on the roster, we wouldn't be horrible without Embiid, right? Yes. Like, so, and
because of the plan to rest him on back to backs, you said, oh, this team constructed to survive and win these games.
They can
Paul
at least
George,
be
Maxi, they have plenty.
They could at least be 500 in those games, right? That's what you would hope, is like they could just keep their head above water, and they're not doing that now. So if I had to bet on it, I guess I would bet them figuring something out and getting somewhere around 500 by the end of the year. But I need to see them win a couple of games before that happens. And to the point about Embiid, like, maybe being cooked, every time he comes back from injury over the last 5 years and he's looked sort of like this, we ask the same question. Is he cooked now? Is that just the injury? And within 2 weeks, he looks normal again, or he looks whatever he is and everything's fine. But I guess I would just say the frustrating point for me is, what has been going on for the last month if it's not getting in shape and ready to play basketball? Like, why does he look so bad this time? I understand the other times, normally what happens is he gets injured, he comes back from injury as soon as it heals, having not played basketball for 2 months or whatever. I get it. I understand. But what has been going on for the last month? Like, training camp was what, 6 weeks ago? You know, what's been going on since then? Why does he look so bad now? And that is what is, I guess, disheartening. If it's being cooked, again, I feel sad for him. If it's that he's not in shape, I'm sort of angry, I guess.
For sure, yes. And I'm sure we'll get more details in the weeks to come about that, depending on how his play develops, as you said. Mm-hmm. And of course, he, you know, may have been sick tonight. He, you know, definitely looks sick the way he was performing out there on the court. Hopefully he's able to get back healthy with whatever it is that's ailing him. The Sixers, on their upcoming schedule, they play again on Wednesday, and they face the Memphis Grizzlies in Memphis on Wednesday. Then they have the Nets at home and the Clippers at home, the Rockets next Wednesday. So that's their next four games. And, you know, I'd hope they don't lose all four of those.
They all sound like losses to me, Kevin, to be quite honest with you. They all sound like losses to me. I don't know. I'm not going to believe they can win game. They have not won a game in regulation this year.
It's crazy.
Both wins have been in overtime, like miracle wins in overtime.
And against Indiana and Charlotte were their wins.
Right.
And they haven't beaten anybody great.
So if I'm to be optimistic about it, my guess is Maxi is back Wednesday or Friday. So that's good. They, you know, again, if I'm painting this in a positive way, all this time, I don't even know if this Jerry McCain thing would have happened if everybody was healthy. So the two parts of that best case scenario are, if he ends up being a trade piece, he's worth way more than he was a month ago. I would guess that. If he isn't a trade piece, he's certainly a rotation player, and certainly at the very least a really, really good six man. At the very, very least, that's if they don't start him. And none of that would have happened if they weren't bad like this. I would say that is the positive part. Maxi will be back. They'll be whole. But it feels pretty bad. You know, it feels really bad.
It does feel really bad. And with Jared McCain, like you said, that is the one silver lining of this season so far. He's
outrageous, man.
Dude, I mean, the stuff he's doing out there on the court, he's leading all rookies in points per game at 15 now. He's shooting 40% from three. In the games since Maxi got sidelined, he has 18, 27, 23, 34, 29, and then 20 on Monday night against the Heat, averaging over 25. Shooting the hell out of the ball, like I talked about on Friday's show with Haverstraw, from three, from mid-range, the little pull-ups, and the playmaking. Like, he's definitely the best passer on the Sixers. His feel, snaking in the pick and roll, drawing a second defender, the cross court kickouts. He needs to continue playing 30 plus minutes per game once Maxey's back. Like, to me, Nick Nurse needs to find a way to make it work with those two. I know they're both smaller guards and Embiid not quite the same right now defensively, but they have to find a way with Maxey and McCain, because those guys, they're the primary source of offense. McCain recently has been the best player on the team. And the things that he's doing, shooting, passing, the mid-range feel, those are all things that we knew he could do. He's just doing them at a higher level than anybody could have anticipated this early in his career. I think those things are sustainable for him.
Yeah, and the other thing is, we've seen, you know, in the early process days, we've seen plenty of high usage players scoring, you know, whether it be MCW or Tony Roten, who I loved, but those guys, while they were fun to watch for that time, they didn't pass the "this guy's an NBA player" eye test. McCain does. McCain, I know this is going to sound crazy, but he's got, a few weeks ago, when was it? It was the middle of October. Our mutual friend, Sam Esfandiari from Light Years, said this thing on his podcast that he was the first true Steph disciple and he would be better than Maxey. And we played it on the podcast and we both laughed at it. And you play it now and you watch how he plays and you're like, he does have these little Steph things to his game, right? About, you were talking about him snaking his way to the rim, or even just the movement off the ball and resetting
relocations.
Yes, right. Like, there's one that was floating around the internet, but it was so perfect. Drove into the lane, passed it to Paul George in the corner, relocated to the wing immediately, got the ball back, shot a three, like bang. And he is, watching him in summer league, I don't watch college basketball, but watching him in summer league and early in the season, I was like, this guy's not it, right? Too small, too slow. I've never done a 180 on a guy like I have with him. He has Steph in his game, and he actually has some Jalen Brunson in his team, in his game too. He doesn't look quite as bullish as Brunson does, but he's got a really strong lower body, and the way that he works his way into mid-range shots, you know, mid-range jumpers, is sort of similar to the way that Brunson does it. Again, it's not quite as physical as Brunson, but he has both those parts to his game. And you mentioned two small guards, and I agree with that. And when I brought up starting him next to Maxey, people said, well, how are we going to beat like Boston with two small guards like that? And I was like, well, how about we beat Detroit and then we can worry about Boston. We'll like cross that bridge when we come to it. And I know the players are different and Donovan Mitchell has a really long wingspan, but Cleveland is starting Darius Garland and Donovan Mitchell at the same time, and they're 15-0. So let's put two guys on the court who can put the ball in the basket. One who seems like he's more of a natural lead guard than the other. McCain seems like a more of a natural lead guard than Maxey. And I think just sort of like the space you're going to be able to create having two guys that are that dangerous shooting along with Paul George with Embiid, it seems like it's the recipe for something. I don't know what it is, but it seems like it's a recipe for something.
I agree there. I think, and that's one of the reasons why I'm not burying them yet. I just can't get there with Philly, because as you said, Embiid has had times in the past. He comes back, he looks absolutely horrible. You're like, is this it? And then 2 weeks later, he's back to averaging 30 and he looks like his dominant self, and everything else is a distant memory until he gets hurt again. And obviously that's the concern, because with even hamstring injuries from Maxey, that could come back. He needs to make sure he's back fully healthy once he returns. Paul George has an injury history as well. Like, no duh, injuries are the concern with Philadelphia this season and always will be during the Joel Embiid era. But I just can't get there with totally burying them yet, despite how horrible they were tonight. I mean, 19-point lead in the first half. How were you feeling when it was 19? Were you thinking, how quickly is this going to go away? What was going on through your mind when it was 19 points in the first half?
I knew they were going to lose. You mentioned Sharp. I told Sharp they would be down 12 with 8 minutes left, and I think they were down 14 with 8 minutes left. Well, Miami was shooting particularly poorly from three, and I suppose that could have happened for the rest of the game, but I didn't imagine it was going to happen the rest of the game. And just like, I don't know, they played well in the first half against Orlando too, but that same thing happened. When the other team turns it up a notch, they seem like they're not able to match the energy. And that part, I think, is on Joel a good extent, because the team's going to follow his energy. And I do think the team is missing Maxey's energy a little bit, because one of the things, along with his play, one of the things you noticed during the Knicks series last year was just that when Joe didn't have it, Maxey was learned to step into that role of not allowing the team to sort of die. And I think without having his energy there, I think they're missing that, because that's not what Paul George is. Paul George, stats aside, has looked pretty good this year, you know, has looked really smooth on defense. The shot hasn't gone down, but I think that it will. Has been pretty good playmaker for a guy that's not that great a passer. But I do think they miss Maxey's energy a lot.
Definitely. I mean, he's so fast, so quick. I think the McCain-Maxey dynamic, they only played 43 minutes together prior to Maxey getting sidelined, and, you know, insignificant sample. But yeah, Maxey's speed, McCain's feel and tempo that he's played at, that dynamic could be pretty fun together if those guys have figured it out and add a different type of look for defenses depending on how you want to attack. So I'm not done with Philly yet. Right now, it's horrible. It looks bad.
You made me feel better. Thanks, Cass.
That is very easy to bet against them right now. And I'm sure this week on, you know, ESPN's First Take and a lot of debate shows, it's going to be about, should the Sixers blow it up and all that? And maybe they should. Like, maybe they should be trading Embiid instead of McCain. That should maybe be the conversation come February. But I'm not there yet. I'm not there pushing the blow it up button. Spike, we got a couple mailbag comments over the weekend from some listeners after I mentioned Linkin Park's new album coming out, From Zero, to Tom Haverstraw on Friday's show. And I know this week you have a live show talking about Linkin Park's new album, From Zero. I'm curious, what did you think about the new album? How'd you like it?
I like it. We're doing the live show because a friend of mine, Jason Lipschitz, wrote a book about Linkin Park called It Starts With One. A great book, which I recommend wholeheartedly. I actually brought a tear to my eye when I was reading the last part of it. I think the album's good. I think it feels like a reset for them, like a very specific, we're going to make a straight ahead Meteora era record for the people who are unsure of Emily Armstrong, like the new singer. Like, we want to show people that we can do a standard Linkin Park album. And I think I don't say that in a negative way. I think they did that. I think there's like two tracks in the middle I don't love, but aside from that, I think it's a good record. I enjoyed it. 31 minutes, which is very, you know, first two Linkin Park albums, very, very Hybrid Theory and Meteora. I think it's good. It makes me want to hear what the next record will be, actually, because the band evolved so much through their career. And the last album they did, One More Light, was really poppy and is much different than this. So I'm curious to see where it'll go, but I liked it. Do you like it?
I liked it too. I mean, the two singles that have been out for a while, The Emptiness Machine and Heavy Is the Crown, I love both of those. I think they're both great Linkin Park songs. And the new stuff that was on the release last Thursday, Two-Faced is very good. Stained is good. Good Things Go, the last song, really, really strong as well. I think those were my three favorites from the new stuff that came out. But I mean, overall, like you said, it is very Meteora esque, you know, style album. Clearly they're trying to hit that nostalgia point with fans, and that's smart on their part. And I think you know, Mike said, you know, like, we wanted to keep Linkin Park because it still sounds like Linkin Park. Still does sound like Linkin Park, very much so.
Yeah. And I know they had debated changing, like, not touring under the name Linkin Park, but I think people are smart enough to understand that it's not Chester Bennington, but it is still Linkin Park. And there's enough in Mike Shinoda, Brad Delson, Joseph Hahn, like those guys are Linkin Park too. And this isn't the first band that ever changed a lead singer. And Chester was an all-time lead singer and was great. But I think, and it sounds ridiculous to say this, I think he would want them to be Linkin Park, you know, as this is. So I enjoyed it. I like Stained a lot too. Casualty, I think, is the name of the song I didn't love. But aside from that, I think it's a good record. And I think all the videos I've seen, unfortunately, I had to miss the Barclay Center show because it was the Eagles home opener. So I couldn't go to the show. I really wanted to, but all the videos I see look like she's really starting to figure out like who she is in the band and get comfortable. So I'm excited to see them. And I think the album's good.
I was there at the show in LA at the Forum.
Oh, how was it?
Awesome. Terrific.
Yeah.
Great show. Great energy in the crowd. There were, you know, I was not in the standing section down low by the stage, but there was like three mosh pits going on at once. So the crowd was really intense. Granted, probably the Linkin Park fans are a little bit older now. People were having a good time. So
yeah,
I was really impressed by the crowd and the band's great. And I want to see them again when they have what, a 50 show tour next year, yeah. I believe. I want to see it again for sure.
It goes on sale. It's like I'm doing a commercial for it. It goes on sale on Thursday, but they're playing Philly. Well, they're playing Philly in August, and I already sent my wife like the date, and I was like, "We're going to this," and she was like, "Do I have to?" I was like, "I'm going to this. It's okay. You don't have to go." But I'm very excited to see them, and I'm happy that they're back. You don't realize what a massive library of music they have until you really start thinking about it, like for the when Jason's book came out, and then when we started thinking about the live show, I went back and I've re-listened to every album so many times. You don't realize how much great music they have until you dive into it that way. So,
what's your favorite Linkin Park album?
So this bounces around. I usually end up with either Minutes to Midnight or A Thousand Suns, depending on the day. Like Thousand Suns sort of like trails off toward the end of the album. I think it's probably Minutes to Midnight. And I think when I listen back to it, the one that I forgot, believe it or not, the one that I forgot was that good was Hybrid Theory. And the one that I think I overrated a little bit when I go back and listen is Meteora. Why? What's yours?
It's Hybrid Theory.
Really.
I mean,
well, it doesn't miss.
It's probably a generic answer, but I think
for
me,
it doesn't miss.
Exactly. Top to bottom, it's an unbelievable album. One Step Closer, Crawling, Paper Cut. I mean, it's In the End, of course, is on it as well. But I don't know. It's like there's this something on social media I saw the other day that they were like looking at YouTube, and it was like they searched on YouTube from before 2006 or something like that. Like you can search on YouTube before 2006, like that real early stuff uploaded on YouTube. Did you see this? Someone posted about this? Okay.
No.
And I went on and I searched Linkin Park Dragon Ball Z because that's how I discovered Linkin Park. It was old, like pre-YouTube, before YouTube, Dragon Ball Z, like compilation clips with Linkin Park as the music for the trailer. So for me, it was all Hybrid Theory at like 11, 12 years old. I'm born in 1990. So I think that was probably the only album out at the time was Hybrid Theory when I went in 01, 02. Because Meteora was 03. So it was all like Goku and Gohan and what a geek.
It's funny. You were born in 1990. I was born in 1976. Makes me feel so old, man. I'll never forget. I've told this story on our podcast or on the music pod at least a few times, but I remember when they came out, I was working in rock radio and I had seen One Step Closer on MTV a bunch of times and we played the song. But that video is so cheesy that they seem like almost like the new metal version of a boy band. You know, one has yellow hair, one has red hair. It looks ridiculous. So I went to see them at a place called the Trocadero in Philadelphia because a band I knew from the area, this band Cinch, was opening up for them. And I was there to see Cinch, but I was like, oh, cool, I'll see Linkin Park. The album had just come out, and this was pre-internet, but people people didn't really listen to albums before they came out. Do you know what I'm saying? Like it's not like everybody knew the music. So I got there and the show was sold out at the Troc and the album hadn't been out for, I don't know, a week or two. And every person in the place knew every word to every song and they were going ape. And I looked around and I've had these moments where I see a band. I'm like, oh, what is this? And I saw that. And it was at that moment that I realized that this is not a fake like band. This is not a label creation. Whatever this is, it is very real and people are very passionate about it. And it was from that point on that I really respected them a lot. I respected all the changes they made and like in their music and all that they explored. I'm really happy that they're back. I'm really happy to see them again. One of my greatest regrets was after Chester died, they had that benefit show in LA and I had two tickets in my cart to buy them and go out there. I was like, oh, I'm not going all the way out to LA for a concert. And I let him go. And I saw a video of this concert and I've never regretted it more. So now anytime I have a chance to see a show that I want to go to, I don't care how tired I am. I don't care how expensive it is or anything like that. I go to the show.
Sometimes you got to have those losses to have future wins, right?
Yes.
It's the truth. Like it's those experiences. Like that's what we live for, right?
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sixers.
Yeah. hopefully they're fun again very soon, but boy, yeah. Oh boy, it's not looking good right now. Spike, I appreciate you joining my show today. Where can we find your stuff and where can people find out details about the live show you have for Linkin Park?
So all the stuff is at RiceRickySanchez.com. The Linkin Park show is just go to CarlLandryRecordClub.com. It's Wednesday, if you're in Philly, Wednesday at a place called Underground Arts in Philadelphia. And the tickets are at the website, CarlLandryRecordClub.com or Underground Arts. Yep.
And you're on WIP every day at what time?
2 p.m. to 6 p.m. with Ike Reese, former Eagles All-Pro Ike Reese and Jack Fritz. We're 2 to 6 every day. We don't talk a lot of Sixers on the radio because they suck so bad, but a lot of Eagles and a lot of fart jokes, a lot of burping, that kind of stuff.
Maybe post-football season.
Post-football season.
We'll see. Hopefully the Sixers are worth talking about at that point because right now they're probably quite forgettable.
Ike told me today, he goes, January, dude. He's like, we're not talking about this team again until January. All right. That's fine with me.
Completely understandable. Well, thank you, Spike. Appreciate you coming on.
Yeah. Thank you, man.
Thank you to Mo DeKeel and Spike Eskin for joining me on today's episode of The Kevin O'Connor Show. Thank you to Stone for producing it. And thanks to you for giving us a listen. Please give us a 5-star rating on iTunes and Apple, a thumbs up on YouTube. It really does help out the show. Hope you enjoy your week. We'll be back again on Friday.